Hi, I'm John Harwood, your host for Bedeviled, a podcast about American democracy from the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University. We bring you conversations with politicians, journalists, and academics about preserving the delicate balance of our fractious system of self-government. But in this episode, something different: the views of Duke students on next week's presidential election. Young voters represent a key target for both Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump. Those under 30 lean Democrat, so Harris is working to maximize her advantage on college campuses and elsewhere. Trump seeks to narrow his deficit among young voters, especially young men, as part of his broader strategy for a winning coalition. So meet Sherman Kreiner, a Duke sophomore, North Carolinian, conservative Christian, public policy major. And Evan Brown, a sophomore from the Chicago suburbs, political science and economics major, and an independent who keeps his distance from both parties. And also Annika Aristimuno, a junior from New Jersey, daughter of immigrants, and president of Duke's Campus Democrats. On this episode of Bedeviled, they give us a window into how young voters see America's choice. Evan Brown, Annika Aristimuno, and Sherman Kreiner, thanks so much for being with us. Let me start by asking, Sherman, as you watch the campaign unfolding between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris and the campaigns up and down the ballot, do you identify with the things that are being discussed in the campaign? Are the candidates talking about things that matter to you?
I would have said vehemently no up until watching the vice presidential debate. I'd say for one thing I'm really, from like a public policy perspective, one thing I value highly is civil discourse. And we haven't really, I mean, we've all seen the debates, like we haven't really seen that practiced. And whether
it's kind of shocking to see it.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, whether or not it was performative or not, I mean, it was very civil. They were shaking hands, like kind of being empathetic with one another. But, Apart from that, I'm somebody who'd probably identify as like a very pro-life person, and mm-hmm. neither party is pro-life like whatsoever. And so that's like the only, if I'm going to like get fired up about an issue, that's the only thing I'd really go vote for. And the GOP put out a pro-choice platform. So, I mean, I really feel like I don't have like a good choice in the election.
So, we're impressed by the style of that and the tone of that. Annika, let me ask you about the issues, though. Do you feel that candidates are speaking to your concerns, or do you find the political dialogue nationally disconnected from your life?
I think that Kamala Harris does a great job at talking to the issues that I'm most caring about this election, specifically access to reproductive freedoms. As a young female in this country, it's honestly horrifying to think that in a couple of years, or even within a couple of months, like somebody can take away all of the access I have to reproductive freedom. And that goes for all female identifying people across the board. Also, Kamala has done a very great job at identifying the fact that the climate crisis does exist and that we need to mitigate that. And in my studies, I've done a lot of work regarding the communities that are most impacted by the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. And I think, just from my studies, I've been able to see how important it is to be recognized and acknowledged and the steps that need to be taken to really fight the climate crisis.
Evan, how about you?
So I think that they're talking about the issues that matter to me, but I'm not satisfied with any of the solutions that they're setting forth. So like as somebody who's going to be entering the job market, I'm very concerned about the availability of jobs. And obviously, as someone who's going to be, you know, looking to be a home buyer, that's something that's pertinent to me. But then, like, I hear Kamala Harris talk about a $25,000 tax credit, and that just seems like a bad solution to me. I don't personally, the abortion issue doesn't resonate fully with me, just because I'm not super personally affected by it yet. But I will say that I agree with the GOP's new stance of kind of devolving that power to the states. That's something that I've believed in for a long time. But I I think they're doing a good job hitting the issues that matter to me, but I'm not completely satisfied with how they're talking about them.
So I think we've identified one issue on which there are different viewpoints in this room. Sherman, you identify as a conservative, but not so much as a Republican. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think one big difference you would see, right, is if you look at Trump's economic policy compared to past Republican presidents, it's very much against free trade. Also, I mean, I think he has very legitimate criticisms about immigration, but I think if you're going to be like a very principled free market conservative, part of that is free movement of labor. And if you're going to be a border hawk, I think that infringes to some extent upon free movement of labor. And that's not to say that we should be doing what the current administration is doing with kind of whole cloth, like letting in tens of thousands of people with temporary protected status. But it's more saying like if we just fully shut down the border, not that that's what the Trump administration is advocating for, but if we have this very hawkish border policy, I think that could infringe upon that. The other thing too is when I think about kind of like more like traditional conservative values, I think one of them certainly would be being pro-life. I also think another one, I mean, I come from like a more traditional Christian background that doesn't explicitly support gay marriage. And I think that's another one where it's like the Overton window has shifted so far to the left in this country that like I kind of feel like I said, I don't really have a place in like any party.
Well, I'm interested. You did not mention any of the behavioral aspects of Trump, the tone he strikes in the campaign, January 6th. How he talks about his opponents, are those negatives for you or is that just not important?
I mean, they certainly are negatives, but like at the end of the day, when I look at both candidates, I'm trying to separate out all of that stuff because you either don't vote or, I mean, you can vote for a third party, but really it's not really doing anything, which I guess that's something we could maybe talk about. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to separate out and be like, if I can find one issue I'm going to vote on, try and figure that out. But yeah, it's definitely, I think it's like disgusting. I think a lot of the rhetoric that Trump uses is pretty bad. I also think a lot of the rhetoric that Kamala Harris uses is pretty terrible as well. January 6th, I mean, you saw in the debate, I think J.D. Vance pretty clearly like destroyed Tim Walz in the debate. But the one part that I'd say was a very low point is he can't admit that they lost the election. And so all of that are certainly negatives for me. They're just not like at the end of the day, there was a peaceful transition of power on, what was it, January 20th or whatever. And so to me, I don't buy the Trump is going to be some like evil dictator. I just think we saw what happened. For better or worse, he stepped down from power.
Evan, give me a little level set on the campus to the extent that you can, because in some way you guys are speaking for your fellow students here on the campus. If you did a student election tomorrow, who would win and would it be lopsided or would it be close?
Oh, absolutely. Kamala Harris would win by a landslide. Duke is quite a liberal campus. I mean, it's an elite university. It kind of should not come as a shock to people, but I think that there has been, even among conservatives, kind of like Sherman was talking about, a disillusionment with Donald Trump and the Republican Party. Maybe it's with Donald Trump, maybe it's with the Republican Party, but people. Almost everybody that I talk to is telling me that they're going to vote for Kamala Harris. I've talked to I really do think there's only been one person that I've talked to that says he plans to vote for Donald Trump.
And do you think in the same way the faculty is lopsided toward the Democratic ticket?
Absolutely. I think that some faculty do a better job of hiding their political views than others. But I do think that at the end of the day, the faculty is also very lopsided towards Harris, yeah.
Well, Annika, one of the things that some people on the right say is that liberal academia, the professors, are pulling, indoctrinating students to the left. Do you think that's true, or is this just about the kind of people who are attracted to a school like Duke University?
I don't think that's true at all. I would say that coming into college, I mean, I grew up, both my parents are immigrants, so I mean, you can say that had an influence on my life, the way I was raised, but I came to college willing to just learn what I was being taught, and what I'm being taught isn't the personal perspectives from my professors. What I'm being taught is from scholarly work from all across the board, from people with completely different backgrounds, experiences, perspectives. And I don't think that professors push their personal beliefs or try to indoctrinate students in any sort of way. What was the second part of your question?
Well, that was mainly it. You agree with Evan that it would be lopsidedly for Harris among students on this campus?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I also agree that probably with the professors too. And I do think that just being at a university where most students that came here were the highest achieving students in their high schools, and that's just the fact of being an elite institution. And I think being the highest performing student or students in your high school leads to having like critical thinking skills and being able to learn from both sides and take information, not just thinking that it's like somebody's personal perspective and running with it, understanding like the context of where it came from. And I think a lot of Duke students have that skill, and therefore that's why I don't think professors are indoctrinating us.
Can I just chime in really quickly? I came from, I have a class this semester where I really, it brings me to disagree with Annika on this issue. I am finding that a lot of the kind of liberal viewpoints of the world, specifically surrounding gender, culture, things of this nature, are being presented to me as fact, and I'm being expected to adopt those same worldviews for better or for worse, whether I like it or not. So I actually disagree. I don't think it happens in every class and in every classroom, but I do think that there are professors that maybe it's not even intentional, but I find that they present these views of the world as fact. And so it kind of feels to me the opposite.
Sherman, let me ask you about something that has been among people following politics a concern or an interest for a while now. One is the idea that young people are simply not motivated to vote in this election to the extent that they may have been in the past. And then a more specific issue is on many campuses, especially in the northeastern part of the country, you've seen intense disagreement, protest over what's happened in Gaza since October the 7th. Duke hasn't really experienced that. Why do you think that is? And is it a reflection of the fact that Duke students are tuned out of politics?
Would I be able to add something onto what Evan was saying?
Sure.
Yeah, so just like a couple examples of kind of, I think, what you're talking about. I think there's different tiers, right, of kind of having like a political orthodoxy or whatever on campus. I think one at the lowest level is kind of like this euphemistic use of language. Mm-hmm. So like if you look at, I've got a couple classes where it says like, this class is an explicitly anti-racist course. And to me, when I read that, it's like most people are like, okay, like would read that as saying, or an uninformed person would read that as saying, the course is not going to be like pro-racism, right? But to me, anti-racism is a completely separate ideology that actually reinforces anti-whiteness. And I think that's just kind of this like little jab at people who just don't hold the view of an anti-racist. The other thing too is like abortion is referred to as reproductive health care. I think that's another euphemism that's used and shows the kind of widespread use of these words. And then the other thing too, if you go on the Duke Chronicle's website, they publish surveys of incoming students. It's like 14% or something like that of students are openly conservative. We only have one conservative organization on campus, and it's not actually conservative. It identifies as libertarian, centrist, and conservative, whereas we have a Duke Democrats chapter. And so I think like the campus environment as a whole is pretty illiberal, to your point. To the second point, I think on the Gaza part, I think it's primarily because Duke is a very, very strong and active Jewish population. We're in the South, but we don't really have like a central like Christian center separate from the chapel. But we have an enormous Jewish, Freeman Center for Jewish Life. And I think that's pretty responsible for it. I think we just have a very active Jewish community that's kind of forcing SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, kind of into their own little pocket off campus. And then for students being involved in kind of like
– Or tuned out of politics, yeah, yeah. Or tuned into it.
Yeah, like voter – like young voter apathy. I don't know. I think it kind of depends on the student. Like I think what I see a lot around campus, there's a lot of kind of what I would call like ballot harvesting efforts. A lot of people coming in trying to get students to vote. And I think that's like a pretty intentional thing by predominantly progressive groups trying to get a segment of the population that they know votes for the Democratic Party to vote for them. And they label it as like, oh, it's a get out of the vote effort. But it's to me, that's pretty clearly a Democratic voting ballot harvesting effort. Alternatively, though, I think I think there's some new use of like social media. Like you have like Trump going on all these podcasts. You have Kamala Harris literally running a TikTok campaign at the beginning. That may have some impact, but at the end of the day, I think it just matters if there's issues that get young people fired up. I think a lot of the students at colleges like Duke and other similar colleges are pretty wealthy and don't feel the economic burdens that are probably going to be motivating most voters. I think, though, there also are a lot of students who come from – I mean, you were saying you came from an immigrant background. I think there's a lot of students who come from immigrant backgrounds that could feel the – on the other side with Trump's rhetoric on immigration can feel that. Other than those issues, I don't really know. Maybe abortion. You also mentioned abortion. Other than those, I'm not sure what's motivating students.
Are each of you guys likely to vote, certain to vote?
100% voting this election.
I will be voting, yes.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the – and I'm going to ask you this, Annika. What did it mean to you that Joe Biden's candidacy in the beginning of the year, and then he left and Harris joined the ticket? How did you feel about that switch, and did it change your level of interest in the Democratic Party and the campaign?
Yeah, so I would say that Joe Biden stepping down completely shifted my interest in helping the Democrats win this election. I was not very motivated to help Joe Biden win this election. Not that I would have rather Trump be the president, but I felt that Joe Biden was getting to the point where he wouldn't be able to understand the needs of the youth and the shifting, just the changes that are constantly occurring in the United States with new generations being born, with all the new technology, et cetera, et cetera. And honestly, I never thought that Kamala Harris would be running for president. This is the first presidential election that I can vote in. And honestly, it is a dream to say that somebody who's a female, two minority backgrounds, like she is a daughter of a South Asian mother, like so am I. And to have that, to see somebody that represents myself be even in a position where they have a strong enough campaign to have the chance to win this election is unbelievable. If I were to have told like my 10-year-old self this, like I don't think I would believe it. To have someone here who understands the struggle of immigrants, who's going to fight for women and trust youth and really focus on the future of this country and not just focus on the wealthy white people is just outstanding.
Do you think your pumped up enthusiasm for the Democratic ticket is a common reaction? Do you think a lot of people feel that?
Yeah, I would say a lot of youth definitely felt a surge within themselves after Joe Biden stepped down. And I think that possibly has to do with just the age of Joe Biden. And a lot of teenagers and young voters felt that, again, like he wasn't representing and wouldn't be able to fight for what they wanted to see for the Democratic Party and what they really cared about. And I think Kamala does a great job of doing that and a good job of prioritizing youth in, like, what she fights for.
Evan, how does the prospect of a woman as president make you feel? And do you think that the country is willing to vote for that? Like, do you think being a female candidate is an obstacle for someone running for president or not anymore?
So first of all, the prospect of a female president, I think it's overdue. I think that we look at a lot of other Western democracies and they have had plenty of female leaders. I think the United States operates with a little bit of a lag as opposed to countries in Western Europe, things like that. But I mean, I absolutely think that it was a great thing that Kamala Harris was elected the first female vice president. I think these are steps that we need to be taking. As far as an electoral disadvantage, I don't think that it's an electoral disadvantage at all. Like we, for instance, we see the population that I would assume that you're talking about is conservative voters. Are they willing to vote for a woman? And I think that we saw in congressional elections, there's record numbers of Republican women being elected to Congress. There really seems to be no electoral disadvantage being female. And I really don't see that as a reason why people wouldn't vote for Kamala Harris.
Sherman, have you been watching the two debates that have been held? You mentioned the vice presidential debate, but what about the presidential debate between Trump and Harris, as well as the one between Trump and Biden before that? Do you tune into those? Do you watch them all the way through? Do they make a big impression on you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first Biden Trump debate, but the only Biden Trump debate, I think it showed. I mean, I disagree with you where you're characterizing it that Biden fell out of touch with voters. I think he fell out of touch with reality. He's clearly like a mentally addled person, and I'm saying that as somebody whose grandfather had dementia. I'm a history and public policy major, but I can't really make the official medical diagnosis. But I think he clearly has mental issues, and I think at some point, like, people just have to be honest and be like, that cannot be our commander in chief, and then we can move on, like you were saying, move on to Kamala Harris, move on to whoever is like the able president. So that was my main takeaway from that. Trump didn't really do anything. He kind of just sat there and was like, as long as I'm not like a jerk, I'm going to win this debate, because his plan was just let Biden kind of kill his own campaign. The Trump-Harris debate, I think, showed a bit more of like a rattled Trump. It showed kind of what most voters probably think of Trump. They think he's like a pretty off-the-cuff speaker. He doesn't come in with like pre-prepared notes. He doesn't
always do the reading before the class.
right. And he's also now, it showed like, I think, a new part of Trump that's a little bit more tapped into social media, where he's talking like the Haitian cats and dogs things, like that came out like shortly before the debate. And so I think he's a little bit more chronically online than he used to be, even though there's all the jokes about his Twitter. But I also think the other thing that stood out to me, and it's going to sound like a broken record, but the moderator's performance in the debate, like I'm trying to have an open mind, but that seemed so incredibly biased against Trump. Like, I think the New York Times was putting out fact checks of both candidates, and there were fact checks that they didn't do on Kamala Harris. There were four on Trump. I just think when we have moderators stepping in, you even saw it in the vice presidential debate, I think it's better if we have the candidates themselves fact checking each other if we're going to do that, because otherwise it's going to get into this like Orwellian sense of definition of truth. And if we just let two people sitting on the stage kind of be able to dictate what the truth is to hundreds of millions of Americans, I think that's a pretty dystopian idea of American politics. So yeah, I mean, really the moderators stood out to me. My mind wasn't really changed by.
Evan and Annika, were either of you disturbed by the behavior of the moderators in the debates?
No. I think what I was honestly proud of from the two female moderators and at the vice presidential debate was how they stood up for themselves as both candidates, honestly, were speaking over the mics, and they had to look at each other and be like, hey, like, we got to keep going. Like, I don't really care what you guys have to say. Like, we have 15 questions to ask you tonight. Like, we have however much time they have. Like, we got to get through this stuff. And like, y'all can argue on your own time, but, you know, we have to get through this. And that honestly made me feel very proud as like watching two women kind of be trampled by one, J.D. Vance. And I know Tim was speaking over it at one point, but I was proud to see them do that.
I was not particularly disturbed by the moderation of the vice presidential debate, but I was by the presidential debate. I think I agree with Sherman that it seemed like they were fact-checking Trump and being tough on him, as I think they should be, but it seems like that was not equally imposed upon Kamala Harris. I think there was an obvious bias there. That may be why they intended to do that, but I mean, I think at any rate, Kamala Harris also told lies in that debate that just kind of went unchecked, and then the American populace doesn't know that both candidates are lying, and they get to it kind of imposes upon them this view that Kamala Harris is always telling the truth, which is simply not true. Neither of them are.
Honestly, as like a full Kamala Harris supporter, I wouldn't say that like I just go blindly thinking that everything she says is true. And I know that that's also true for some Trump supporters. But also, Sherman, to your point about Biden being incapable of like being president again, like, do you think that Trump is any more capable with his like mental status?
I mean, if you're talking about mental fitness, I think Trump is certainly more capable. But if you're talking about like personality and you're talking about whether or not he's like presidential, I would say no. Like, that's one of the reasons why I don't really like Trump. I don't think he's a very presidential person, but I don't think someone who's trying to be objective and just kind of look at American politics for what it is and not what they want it to be, I don't think you can look at Joe Biden and say that person is the president of the United States. I think that's the reason why he was replaced, right? Like, yeah. There's no other explanation. Yeah.
And I want to really quickly, I want to speak to your point about, even though you're a full Kamala Harris supporter, you don't take everything that she says kind of blindly. And I think that that's really good. And that's a very, very high information kind of privilege. I think what we have to consider is that a lot of the country are watching these debates to inform their votes. And they don't, especially if they're in the middle or lower classes, they may not have time to go do their own research. So the media has a lot of power in dictating what is perceived as fact. And so I think I think that they need to really keep that in mind when they're moderating these debates, is that their image that they curate is very powerful in shaping the votes of voters.
Yeah, I agree. But I also think if someone's on stage saying that immigrants are eating cats and dogs, which is like completely untrue, that like something like that to such extremes, like I think if you're looking at the percentage of like extreme lies versus maybe like a slight embellishment of like numbers or something versus something as harsh as literally a statement leading to physical violence in a town, that like it just makes sense to me that like that part, those statements need to be corrected in the moment versus like, oh, 1,000 people got jobs versus a 2,000 people got jobs. You know, I feel like sometimes depending on the statement. Well, I think that adds to the like issue that we're all kind of discussing of like, how do you moderate like a how do you
moderate
debate?
There. It's
yeah,
difficult.
Like I can't even imagine. You know, like how do you fact check? Like, what do you fact check if like 90% of it is lies? What do you pick and choose? How do you stay on track with your questions? And how do you like, you know, oh, this, you know, this sentence was really out of whack, so we're going to correct that. But maybe in my perspective, I think Trump gave more out of whack sentences that maybe needed to be corrected than Harris did, and that's my perspective. So I think it's a tough thing all around, but it's good to hear like the conversation about it.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, like, I would agree with your last point about, like, it depends on our perspectives, because, I mean, I think there was only one fact check. I wasn't able to watch the entire debate in the debate a night or two ago. But you have the fact check about the, what was it, the CBP-1 application, the immigration application. And, like, I could kind of understand why they'd do that, even though I don't really think it's the role of the moderators, especially when they agree before the debate not to fact check. But I think another thing is, like, if you see, like, the cats and dogs, like, this is a crazy thing, and, like, I don't know if it's been substantiated or not, but like I take that it's like a pretty wild statement to make. I think the same goes for Tim Walz, just like declining the fact that he actually allowed decreased restrictions on protecting the baby's life and partial birth abortions. And if you're a pro-life person, you look at that and you're like, that is one of the most disgusting things a politician can do. And there's no fact check on that. And so like I think it goes both ways with like who gets to control the truth and like what is extreme to one person. That's why I think when a moderator steps in, it's pretty disgusting.
Evan, let me reconnect with something you said a few minutes ago when we talked about American democracy lagging behind other Western democracies. What do you see as the stakes in this election? There are two things that that have been I think gotten the lion's share of attention in terms of the projection of high stakes onto the election. One of them is abortion rights, reproductive freedom, whatever you want to call it. The Democratic campaign is running on the idea that there is a fundamental difference and the Republicans would take us one way and Democrats take us the other way. The other argument is that the democracy itself is threatened by January 6th, by the behavior of Donald Trump then and since. Do you agree that the stakes in the election are that large?
Yes, I do. So I don't know if you kind of read my little blurb that I sent you, but I lean conservative on, I would say, a majority of the issues. But I really think that what has yanked me back to the center has been Donald Trump, and especially after 2020. I see Donald Trump's phone calls with secretaries of state trying to tell them to find him votes, and his just outright denial that he lost an election. That to me is something that feels very dangerous, and it feels very dictatorial.
Does it feel dangerous to you, Sherman?
I mean, I think, yeah. I was talking about ballot harvesting earlier. I don't know what's a more pure form of ballot harvesting than asking an elected official for votes.
Yeah, it it is, that is something that really feels, that really feels it, that for that reason, it does feel like the stakes are very high. I want to also speak to what you said about American democracy lagging behind European democracies. What I meant by that was kind of lagging behind in this leftward shift. I didn't mean that as like a inherent positive or negative, but I think that the kind of the direction of the world is shifting more left, and the European countries outpace the United States in that kind of shift.
Annika, how do you see the stakes in the election? Are they very large?
I would say so. I think just like your example, like January 6th, I think Trump really, really resisted the peaceful transfer of power. I mean, ultimately, I think he just had to, because if he didn't, like, I mean, we'd be in a different state right now. But I think he clearly struggled with that. And even you can see during the vice presidential debate, J.D. Vance could not admit that Donald Trump lost the 2020 election, which is just insane, because it's 2024. Like, we're coming into a new election. You know, honestly, like, get over it. It's not even at the point where he could still argue it and go back. Like, it's not 2020, a month after the election, where he's like, oh, man, I lost. Like, I'm going to fight as much as I can to try and prove to people that I won. Like, we're really far past that point. So I think that is just one example of how much of a threat Donald Trump is. And if he loses this election, who knows what will happen? And just to touch on some of the things that he said he plans to do for his upcoming presidency. I mean, he claims he has no affiliation with Project 2025, but I think there are clear ties and connections to him and that project and his people and advisees and advisors, et cetera, and his entourage. And I think everything in Project 2025 is a threat to democracy. I think the idea of the president, I think just Trump placing these Supreme Court justices that are making decisions that negatively impact so many people across this country and across the world, like, that's a threat to democracy. The fact that this summer I was in D.C. at the Supreme Court waiting for them to hand down these decisions on the last day of the term, hoping that they're going to, like, grant emergency health care to women who are going to die if they don't receive an abortion, like, that shouldn't even be an issue. You know, if somebody's going to die, like, doctors should not be scared of going to jail for performing an emergency healthcare service. Like, I mean, that might be my pro-abortion service, like, perspective. But I think there's just multiple things that Trump has shown, his followers have shown, J.D. Vance has shown that they will be a threat to this democracy.
I think this was really this really was brought to the forefront of my mind when I went and heard Liz Cheney speak when she came a few weeks ago. She described an instance from January 6th that she had talked about with, I forget exactly which representative or senator, whoever it was, but they walked in to the room where Donald Trump was watching the insurrection happen on the TV, and they handed him a note that said that somebody had just been shot. And he looked at it and he handed it right back to them and just, like, shoot him away. I just think that to have somebody like that in the Oval Office is concerning, really concerning. And she also talked – I don't have time to go into everything right now, but she talked about the breadth and depth of his plans to overturn the election, and how when one thing failed, he went right on to the next, and there were dozens and dozens of cases. And I do want to push back a little bit on this Supreme Court point. I think that the Supreme Court is often seen as people imposing their personal beliefs about issues upon the American populace. And I just really could not disagree more with that. I think it's very important to keep at the forefront of our minds that the Supreme Court's job is to interpret the constitutionality of certain laws, certain decisions. And the Supreme Court justices did not rule the way that they did because they are pro-life. They are more constructionist in their view of the Constitution, and that is why they ruled the way that they did. And so I think I also disagree with the point that appointing Supreme Court justices can be a threat to democracy, because the Supreme Court is inherent to our democracy. And it's the president's responsibility to appoint them. So I don't quite
appointing Supreme Court justices that are going to do everything you want them to do is different than appointing Supreme Court justices that you know are going to follow their job and follow the Constitution. I was also at the Liz Cheney talk, and she spoke a lot about how Donald Trump and this Trumpist idea and the Trumpism people have really stepped away from supporting the Constitution. And she honestly, she said, she was like, I don't think that the Republican Party right now, like what Trump represents, is representative of the U.S. Constitution. She was like, and that's basically why, part of why she's not voting for Trump this election. And I mean, it was amazing to have her here and to have her endorse Kamala Harris on Duke's campus. That was absolutely magnificent. But yeah.
But I think, sorry, go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to ask, I mean, Do you really think Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and who's the other one?
Neil Gorsuch.
Yeah, Neil Gorsuch, the Trump appointees, went through law school. They were professors at these esteemed law schools for decades. Are just taking on this like MAGA legal ideology, or they have something separate? I think that's like a very progressive idea to think that these people are selected because they're just like these MAGA legal theorists, which is like a new term that didn't even exist prior to then. It's more so they're originalist Supreme Court justices. They look at the entire point of being an originalist, right, is you're trying to look at the Constitution for what its meaning was at the time when it was written. And I'd be curious, because that's the originalist interpretation of constitutional law. I'd be curious what yours is if you disagree with that, because I'm not sure what the Supreme Court justices are supposed to do other than interpreting the document for what it says at the time within the context of what it said.
Well,
and if you don't have an answer, it's not like a gotcha moment. It's just like that's something I very much care about, and like my opinion is that like I don't think the left really has an answer to that question. That's not, well, whatever we kind of think is what a government should be doing.
I wouldn't agree that it's like whatever we think like the government should be doing is like what the government should do. I think there's fairness in when you look at like what Trump has done with these specific people and what they tend to support and like what other Supreme Court justices tend to support. And like I think it's a very complicated matter. And I think personally, for me, the experience and learning about like reproductive freedoms and learning about like when I grew into an age where that even was on my mind and that mattered to me, knowing that they were being stripped away from me slowly, like, but surely, that really caught my attention. And like, I just think, I don't know how to answer this question, honestly. I think somebody can have extensive experience in law school. Someone can have extensive elite education and still, in my opinion, make bad decisions and still make decisions that harm specific groups of people.
Yeah, let me go back to one thing, and then I'm going to ask you guys to talk a little bit more about democracy. Are either of you guys, Sherman and Evan, bothered by what you know about Project 2025?
I mean, I was going to say I have not looked into it. Into Project 2025, I assume it's probably like hardline. I mean, you were speaking that you thought it was disgusting. I would assume it's like hardline pro-life stances and
I mean, it's
pretty like very conservative.
400 pages.
Yeah, it's like I have classes and homework and stuff. but not to downplay it, but yeah, I haven't looked into it. But the one thing I was going to say real quick when we were talking about democracy, I think, once again, I was talking about euphemisms earlier. I think describing America's system as a democracy is, once again, a progressive euphemism. It's a lot more accurate to say that we're in a constitutional republic. And once again, this is a thing that like a lot of people on the right get made fun of for saying. But if you actually read what the framers of the U.S. Constitution wrote when they created the Constitution, if you go look at the Federalist Papers, they very much feared the majority. They feared the will of the majority. And that's why we have a Senate. That's why originally you had the Senate was actually appointed by state legislature. That's why you have an electoral college. They're trying to create some semblance of democracy while also distancing and creating like a more like virtuous educated citizenship class or whatever that's controlling. So I think when we just talk about democracy as if like everyone is like the 51% is supposed to govern. That's why like people on the left, when they say we need to get rid of the electoral college, just go for pure popular vote. When I hear that, I'm like, that person just fundamentally does not understand what the United States was founded on, what the system of government, why it works, why we have gridlock. And so I just like, I don't know, I would challenge the question of democracy. I don't think When we talk about America, we should talk about it in a democratic context.
Yeah, so I do agree with you that the United States was not made to be a democracy. We were made to be a federal republic. For me, I just use the word democracy because that's kind of how we refer to it. That's what's in the news, whatever. And to me, it kind of more resembles not so much the actual literal definition of democracy, but kind of respecting the will of the people in the context of the system which we have. And I want to go back to your question about Project 2025. I have not read too much of it. From what I've seen, it is a lot of the points of it are very concerning, very, very far right. But I absolutely am not worried about it in the slightest, because this is not like it's very important to keep in mind. This is not something that was created by the Trump campaign or by Donald Trump or even endorsed by Donald Trump. It was made by a far right think tank. And I think that distinction is
by a lot of people very close to Donald Trump and who have had senior positions under him and will.
I think we have to keep in mind, we all know Trump is a very independent thinker. He's not going to do, if he doesn't want to do something, he's not going to do it. So I really don't think that this is something that we have to worry about being implemented.
The thing is, it aligns with all of his ideas. It aligns with all of his plans. So it makes sense. Maybe he'll say like, oh, I don't support this. Or maybe he'll be like, oh, he's not going to do this. He's independent. Yeah, that man, I can't even explain him. He's on his own planet, honestly. And like, maybe he won't put it into place, but I think there's a very, very high chance that if Donald Trump is elected, a lot of Project 2025 will go into place.
Can I say two things? So one, I think like, once again, I think that's progressive fear-mongering. And I think Trump ran on lock her up. Is Hillary Clinton in jail? No. Like, I think when we say—
He tried.
Yeah.
Okay, well, how so?
He tried to get his Justice Department to open an investigation of her.
Okay, well, I mean, that's fair. I could also make the same argument with the Biden DOJ member in New York creating up a fake charge. I'm not a defender of Trump, but I mean, that's very clearly what happened. I have family who's in the law, and they said that's effectively the same thing that happened, that you have weaponization of the judiciary. So that point aside, and I'll admit when I'm wrong, that point aside, I want to say, to kind of get rid of the fear-mongering point, the Heritage Foundation has been doing this since Reagan. They have been putting out these presidential transition memos or whatever since Reagan, and I don't necessarily think that means that this is like some new scary thing. Like, I think this has happened for – I don't even think they necessarily do it for a Republican president. I think it's just a memo that they put out, or like a book or whatever you would want to call it, that they put out for the incoming president. And so I think like we're acting like it's a new thing.
This is exactly what the new conservative president should do, administration.
Do you really think that the Republican Party of Ronald Reagan and the conservative movement of Ronald Reagan is like the conservative movement and Republican Party of Donald Trump?
No, not at all. And that's why I have my criticisms of Trump. But I also I'm not even sure if I would vote for Trump. Like, it's more I want to be fair, and I want to look at it and say, like, Project 2025 is being talked about as this thing that just popped up out of the blue. I'd be very shocked I know the Heritage Foundation was very much aligned with Reagan. I'd be shocked if everything in that was reflected in the Reagan administration. I mean, there's a lot of arguments, my critiques earlier, that Trump wasn't conservative. You can make the same arguments about Reagan. So the Heritage Foundation is a hardline conservative organization. I
just want to say a few things. I think how the Democrats are approaching this issue is very dishonest. If I see a bunch of ads, we're in North Carolina, swing state, obviously we get a bunch of ads. A bunch of Kamala Harris ads say Trump's Project 2025, things like that. When Donald Trump has openly espoused views opposite to Project 2025. Project 2025, I know there's a lot in there about abortion and like a federal agency to like hunt down women. Donald Trump has said that he doesn't support a federal abortion ban. I assume that Project 2025 does support a federal abortion ban. So that Project 2025 is not the GOP platform. And I think that if you want to know what the GOP is going to do if they're elected, you should look at their official platform.
Annika, let me ask you a question that goes to some of the structural things that were alluded to before about Supreme Court and Electoral College. Are you satisfied with the way our democracy functions today? Or do you think that we need substantial reform in the system to make it more representative of the popular will?
Yeah. I would say that there are ways that our current like democratic system does reflect the people that reside in it, but I also think there are many ways that it does not. For example, I'm just going to talk a little bit about North Carolina and like youth voter disenfranchisement. So it has been very hard to kind of fight these challenges that students are facing in getting their vote to count this election. For example, the Republican Party just won a case against UNC to have their digital student ID not count. And that leaves, I think, over 30,000 students at UNC without a physical ID, which means that if they're out-of-state students and they're registering to vote during early voting, they don't have a way to register for that. And that brings an extreme challenge, and that leads to more provisional balloting, which leads to more ballots just being thrown and not being counted because students don't know how to cure their provisionals, and a plethora of other issues.
You think, by the way, that students will overcome that obstacle, or it's actually going to be an effective bar against a lot of student votes?
Yeah, I would say right now on Duke's campus, there's a lot of work being done to make sure that Duke students are able to vote and have their vote actually counted in this election. Before like the beginning of this school year, I had no idea that you can go to vote just for your vote not to even count. I had no idea that it existed, and I'm working very hard with some with professors and students on a Bass Connections team here at Duke working to fight that. It's a nonpartisan group. We're just focused on making sure that students' votes count this election. And I would say that the, like, almost the purposeful limiting of youth from performing their right to vote is, I think, an attack on democracy. I think that, yeah, we have the Electoral College, but a big thing in the United States is the right to vote and the right to have your voice counted in what happens in this country. Whether it has an impact or doesn't, you still have the right to vote. And I think that being threatened shows that there needs to be things that are fixed.
Evan, do you think that our democracy is functioning well? Are you satisfied with it, or do you think it needs major reforms?
Do you mean in like the systemic ways in which it's set up, or in with the current politicians that are kind of at the spearhead of it?
I'm talking systemically, really. There's a push by some people. In fact, I did a last week's podcast with Ian Basson, who heads a group called Democracy, Protect Democracy, and he's looking to what he calls a fourth founding of the country, which will make it more reflective, because he thinks the country's gotten out of balance in some ways between what comes out of the political system and what the populace wants. So he's looking at Electoral College reform, structure of the Senate reform, filibuster, gerrymandering, those kind of things.
Yeah, so I am a very, very big proponent of minority rights. I think kind of like Sherman was speaking to earlier, our country was not formed to be a country where the majority can – if you get 50% plus one vote, you can just control everything in the country. That's why we see we have the U.S. Senate in addition to the U.S. House of Representatives. I think that we strike a very good balance. I am very much in favor of the Electoral College, which is kind of an unpopular view, and it often gets me gets the Republican label slapped on me. But I just think it's very important that people who do not live in densely populated urban areas – oftentimes along the coast, get a fair representation in our electoral system. I think if you were to take it away, you would see the neglecting of industries like farming, where there's not a lot of votes to be won there, but it's an industry that's vital to our country and the world. We feed a lot of the world. So I think that this also with the filibuster, I think that. We have to be cautious as to how quickly we move forward with things. And in order to ensure that things are not just, okay, Democrats have won power, they pass all these laws, Republicans win power in 2 years, they just repeal everything, and you go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. I think this forces compromise, which I think is a very good thing. It prevents people from being able to implement.
It also forces inaction, complete inaction at times as well.
Yeah, it does cause gridlock. And I don't think that we have a perfect system, but I think that we have the best system that we can have.
Sherman?
Yeah, I guess I can touch on a couple things. So one, I think your point about inaction is a is a valid point, and I think my response to that would be that we have grossly overstepped the original structure of what our government is meant to be. That at least from my perspective, I think the framers understood that local government is a very valuable part of government, that we live in a federalist system, that local state governments should be performing the majority of kind of police power, of commerce, regulation, and things like that. And I think that now we have all these different three-letter agencies, we have all these different executive departments that, I mean, some of them, I'm not even entirely sure what they're doing. We have the Department of Homeland Security, and we have a clear problem at the border. I'm not going to talk about whether or not, like, who should be held accountable for that. But I think we have placed too much of government into the federal system. And once again, that's a critique I have of Trump's. Trump is not a small government person. I would prefer a smaller government. I think it's more effective. People are more accountable at the lower level. I think from electoral reform, I would agree with you. I definitely would support the Electoral College. But I think we can change things. Like, we can shorten the length of the campaign season. And I mean, basically now we just have perpetual campaigns. Trump has been campaigning since 2015, basically, even when he was in office. He was campaigning. Same goes for a Democratic president. I think that whenever somebody is in office, they are very much thinking about the next campaign cycle. So we can maybe shorten that. I also think ranked choice voting would be a potentially good addition. And I also think voter ID, like voter ID to me, the arguments against voter ID, and I think you're saying that, like, you think that the policies that you were talking about a policy that institutes like very strict voter ID regulations, correct? I just think the arguments against it, like, are like laughably bad arguments. Like, it's basically saying,
not to say that, like, you shouldn't support like a strict ID, like, law or policy, but if it's 35 days before the election and you are purposely disenfranchising 30,000 students because you know that if those 30,000 students vote, they're not voting your way. Like, this isn't by, like, North Carolina Board of Elections. This is by the Republican Party. It's not just like a, oh, clearly your student ID doesn't count. Like, I understand that. A digital ID.
So, like, we should have mandatory voter ID for voting in an election? Because that's like that's a controversial point. Like, progressives do not agree with that stance.
I think
they say it's
there's
racist.
There's multiple levels of IDs that somebody should be able to use.
Such as?
A passport, a driver's license.
So mandatory
voter
student
ID. Mandatory in which way? Like, you have to have.
Yeah, like, if you're going to vote, like, you have to verify you are the person. Like,
yeah, I think that makes sense. Because why would you not want to verify who it is? Like, you should only be able to vote in one state, which is how it works. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a dead person can't vote. Obviously, you want to vote where you live. Those things make sense.
Yeah, and
Sherman, let me ask you this, though. What problem are you trying to solve?
With
mandatory voter ID, because we don't have any substantial amount of voter fraud in the country.
It's more just a question of why don't we have it? Most countries, I believe, do have mandatory voter ID. So if we're talking about Western democracy, I think it's pretty rich when people point to it when it agrees with them, and they don't point to it when it actually contravenes their position.
But what is the problem?
What is the problem? I'm saying I don't necessarily.
You don't see a problem. In other words,
well, I mean, there could be a problem.
You think on principle,
I haven't looked. Yeah, on principle,
it.
I think that's true. There could be like mass voter fraud. I don't really think that's true. The other thing I was going to say, you were talking about campuses. I mean, this is another probably unpopular position, but I'm against students being able to vote in the state where they go to school unless they're a resident of that state. I just really don't think that makes so much sense. Like, you don't have an understanding of that state's politics in the way that you would if you grew up and you're in that state. I also think that kind of undermines the community aspect of being in the state, but that's kind of a lesser point.
Let me close with this. This debate or discussion has been like the vice presidential debate that you alluded to in one respect. It's been very congenial and civil and cordial. Is that how all political discussion on this campus is, or are you guys just being nice because we're in the studio together? Do you find sharp, emotion-filled clashes on campus, or is that not present here? Annika?
I think it depends on who you're talking to, obviously. I think I definitely surround myself with people who have similar perspectives to me, and that's not to say that I'm never, like, seeking or never willing to have a conversation with somebody who has an opposing view or a slightly opposing view. And I'm always willing to have that conversation and sit down and just like, it's really nice when you get to hear people's stories and understand why they may believe something some way. And like, maybe it's something to do with the way they grew up or whatever it may be. I think on campus, it really varies. I think I'm not sure how much to speak to this, but I'm the president of Duke Democrats, and we've had some clash with an Instagram account called Duke for Trump, and they've spent their time purposefully shunning and, like, saying all this hateful comments about Harris on their platform rather than, like, promoting Donald Trump and his, you know, policies that he plans to put into place. And for us, it's not really a sense of, like, we're going to attack the other. It's more of just, like, we're proud of what our candidate has said and put forward, so we're just going to promote that and whatever. So that is, like, one slight example of where there was, like, a little bit of some harsh, like, comments back and forth on Instagram, and maybe a post or two that was a little interestingly aggressive. But I haven't had many conversations with students. There's been a couple of students who we had a watch party for the presidential debate at Kraft House that Duke Democrats, the Ciceronian Society, and the political science department and a bunch of other organizations on campus hosted together. And we were there, the Duke Democrats, like handing out signs, and we made a little presidential bingo, et cetera. And there were some students who would come up to us and like laugh at the signs, or somebody was like, oh, do you have any Trump signs? And we're like, oh, no, we don't, because like we're the Duke Democrats. So we weren't given any Trump signs by our, you know, supporters. And I feel like that was some of the slight, like another example of slight.
Sounds pretty minor, though. I mean, yeah. Do you agree? Yeah. So, civil campus, would you say?
For the most part, yes. Now, I have personally experienced instances where I have shared a viewpoint that is not popular, and I have had, like, I had one of my classmates, at, like, absolutely scream in my face. Like, at the top of her lungs, scream in my face because she hated this policy. And I think that is a result of a lot of Duke students coming from liberal bubbles where they've never really met somebody who may hold a conservative viewpoint that I hold. A lot of Duke students are from New York City. There's not that many Republicans in New York City. California, like kind of the Bay Area, the Pacific Northwest, these are areas where I feel like people have been put in these bubbles, and then the only way they know how to respond to a viewpoint they don't like is with anger. So I think that is present, and I think that's important to acknowledge, but I do think that the majority of the time we have intellectual, civil, cordial discussions.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think at least I can speak from my experience and then kind of maybe talk about broader on campus. But in my experience, yeah, I've had, like what you were saying, I've had a lot of experiences with kind of intolerance and like illiberalism on campus. Like one example, one of my friends and I, we were in a student government organization, and we were in this like anti-racism training. I spoke about it earlier. I disagree with that as an ideology. I think it's a very destructive ideology. And we like were not agreeing with what the people were saying, and we weren't doing it in like a very kind of vulgar manner. We were just asking questions like, why equity? Why not equality? Like, why are we using these frameworks? And then we were put, like, after that, we were then put in an interview room. We were then asked, like, all these questions, like, why don't you take this seriously? Do you not think, like, racism is a real problem? And then my friend...
Put in an interview room by who?
By students. Yeah. Sorry. It's a good clarification. And then my friend was then kicked off because in the interview, I don't know how his interview went, but I would assume it was not the most cordial environment. And then broader on Duke's campus, yeah, I think I would agree that it is largely civil. There are these little pockets, but I don't think it's civil because Duke has like mastered bipartisanship and civil discourse. Like you mentioned, you're president of Duke Dems. We don't have a Duke College Republicans.
There's a reason for that.
Well, yeah.
There's multiple reasons for that.
Yeah, I was like,
you can start one if you wanted to. They're in the process of starting it. So I don't think that's a good thing to say that Duke is very liberal because we have a Duke Dems chapter and not a Duke Republicans chapter. There's a reason why the Republicans were kicked off campus.
I've read the article.
So
yeah. No,
let's not use that as like, oh, Duke is so liberal because we have Republicans.
That wasn't the causal relationship I was going to make. I was going to say we don't have a Duke College Republicans, but we have a Ciceronian Society. If you're listening to this and you don't know who Cicero is, you're going to be like, what? Like, what is this? Like, who is Cicero? And I think the point that the conservative community on campus has to hide behind an ancient philosopher's name and has to create a big tent organization for centrist libertarians and conservatives versus just saying, I'm a proud conservative, I'm a proud libertarian, whatever. I think it speaks to the fact that a lot of conservative Duke students just aren't comfortable sharing their opinions. And I think it's more like social conservatives. I think our econ department is a pretty fiscally conservative department. But yeah, I would push back a little bit on the notion that our civil discourse is like this virtuous thing that Duke has mastered.
Okay, last brief question. Who are you voting for?
probably going to write in my mom.
I don't know that I'm comfortable sharing that.
I think I know how you're voting.
Kamala Harris.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate the discussion.
Thank you.
It was nice.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Bedeviled. This podcast is possible because of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University. It's produced by Maria Luisa Fresson Norton. Music from Blue Dot Sessions. You can listen to Bedeviled on all podcast platforms.